Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Forged in Fire, where we explore how LGBTQ+ leaders develop their leadership superpowers. You'll hear from guests as they share how they navigated their journey through adverse and crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram. I'm an astronautical engineer in the United States Space Force and one of the senior transgender officers in the military. I'm a passionate advocate for the value inclusion brings to organizations.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to another episode of Forged in Fire. Joining us today is Miguel Mansour. Miguel is a father of two, economist, and a senator in the Parliament of Aruba, where he's the founder and party leader of Acción 21. Miguel was born in Aruba and has studied and lived around the world. His life, though privileged, has not been easy. He is open about his struggles with depression and substance abuse in his youth as a way to escape from his pain. However, with love, support, and resilience, he believes that these experiences have helped shape him into the person he is today. Miguel understands the struggles that many members of the community face and how the stigma around mental health and being different is still prominent in the society we live in. He hopes that by stepping into the political arena, he can aid in making Aruba a more accepting and inclusive society for all ethnicities, cultures, backgrounds, and orientations that make the island diverse and unique. Miguel, thank you so much for joining us today. It's wonderful to have you. As a matter of fact, as the second parliamentarian from the Kingdom of the Netherlands to join us, which is, we think, is pretty cool to get kind of this international reach and to be able to speak with you. So we're honored to have you join us on Forge and Fire.
Well, it's a privilege to be here, and I think it's a wonderful program, and I'm excited to share a little bit about my experience.
Thanks so much, Miguel. The work that we do really focuses on how life experiences of LGBTQ individuals shape them into the people and the excellent leaders that they are today. And you mentioned in your bio a little bit about some of the struggles in your early life and how those, in fact, shaped you and informed you today. And we were hoping that you could share a little bit of that story with us.
Absolutely. So I was born and raised in Aruba until the age of 14. The Caribbean at that time was a very homophobic place. And also kind of I grew up in quite a conservative family. So I think the first signals or cues I got with respect to gay persons was that, you know, they were worthy of rejection and ridicule. And at that time, there was no representation. You know, I think the LGBT people that were did exist. They were not in, definitely not in positions of power or public office. They were oftentimes not leaders in industry. So generally, they were very marginalized and not in public view. So, you know, I think my experience probably right before teen, you know, I knew it was a little bit different, maybe around the age of eight and stuff like that. But it was not something that I knew how to reconcile or even fathom living my truth. So, you know, from that early age, it became a process of hiding and creating kind of, let's say, this image that, you know, was maybe more like my peers and what I thought was acceptable. And that carried on. You know, I went to boarding school in Europe and then university. I remember in university, you know, I was in the United States in Boston. It was the first time I had the liberty and I guess safety to experience some of those feelings that I was having towards of attraction towards members of the same sex. And you know, and I remember when that first happened, it was such a chaotic thing to experience afterwards psychologically, because I'm like, how am I going to reconcile this with the life I planned? I think to this day in the Caribbean, if you're openly gay or lesbian or trans, you are going to face stigma, hostility, and it's going to affect your career possibilities. So, you know, we're making progress, but that stigmatization still exists. So it's not, you know, in my experience personally, all of this reconciled this obviously led to issues of addiction and alcoholism. And, you know, I remember at one point in my life, I worked a lot with people that were recovering from addiction. And if you see addiction rates amongst LGBT people are much higher than the general population, more than double. So, you know, oftentimes these traumatic experiences that we have, you know, can lead to escape in other areas. And it's for me, it was kind of, let's say, it gave me a space not to have to face my truth and not have to reconcile that with the life I wanted to lead. So I had a lot of, I'd say, dark years in my early 20s where I was busy I was in a self-destructive stage. Thankfully, I came out of that. And then it was kind of, let's say, okay, what am I going to do with my life? I always say politics, it was unexpected. It was not my career trajectory. I worked in private enterprise before that. And something happened during the pandemic. I was living in Florida at the time, in Miami. And, you know, during lockdown and during the pandemic, I ended up commenting. I published an article. At that time, you know, Aruba was receiving billions in financial aid from the Netherlands to carry through. We had shut down our borders, so no tourists were coming. We're an economy that depends 90% on tourism. So just to keep the economy and businesses and workers afloat, we received financial assistance from the Netherlands. That financial assistance was conditional in a sense that they would like to see certain reforms just to make our economy more resilient and dynamic. And kind of, let's say, they wanted to force the politicians into working on some of our structural imbalances. So there was this period of negotiation where the government was, dragging their feet not to sign the agreement. And I published an article on this and, you know, kind of pointed fingers as like, well, you know, we're in the situation that we need to borrow from the Netherlands because of financial mismanagement of, you know, the last 20 years. Our economy does well. So if our public finances had been managed in a responsible way, we would have been able to go on the international debt markets, borrowed our needs, and we wouldn't have had to have this agreement. But sadly, you know, our debt to GDP ratio was out of control. So we were not a good, I guess, lesser or a good borrower. And so our balance sheet was not. So I published this article. I think I remember it was July 18th, 2020. And it went viral. And then so the article came out on a Saturday. And then on a Sunday, I started getting calls to enter politics. And of course, I thought they were going to call me, like some political leaders and, you know, some community leaders who started calling me. From Aruba, I was in Miami. At that time, I hadn't lived in Aruba in about 30 years. I'd always come back on holiday, but I'd lived the last 30 years between North America and Europe. And my immediate response was no, absolutely not. And I remember that Friday, a friend of mine, Patrick, who's an author, you know, and kind of like a mentor, like I respect his point of view. He said, you know what, Miguel, when I make a decision, I always go back to it 24 hours later and ask myself, if I take fear out of the equation, would I have made the same decision? And when he said that, I was like, darn. And then, yeah, there was like some political instability on literally a week after. And they called in. They're like, we need an answer. Like, you know, the government might collapse. Are you coming? Yes or no? And I said, yes. And then, you know, the next morning I woke up, I'm like, you have gone mad. You need to call them and tell them, like, you know, you were just kidding. But it kind of led to me entering the public arena, founding a party. And it was kind of, let's say, you know, it's also been an incredibly healing process, coming back to my home country, I guess, reconciling all those feelings that, you know, my experience was that at 14, I chose to go to boarding school and get as far as away as I could, because that's the only way I could have imagined continuing to exist. So I think those experiences or whirlwind of emotions and kind of, let's say, that has you moving country to leave a homophobic society, to trying to reinvent yourself, to kind of each time trying to fit in until kind of you hit a brick wall. And it's like, you know, if I'm going to live, I'm going to have to be me. And that is incredibly empowering, but it's also, you know, it's, and I find that I myself had to kind of like come to acceptance about that. And it's like learning to do life again in a certain sense. My experiences with coming out itself were for the most part pleasant. I had made it a much bigger issue than, you know, most of the people I love and care for that were in my life that day thought it was. And so that was, you know, it's been a slow healing process. And I have to say, I remember I graduated my undergraduate in 98. And at that time, you know, there wasn't, same-sex marriage didn't even exist anywhere. So like the thought of like, you know, one day getting married or, you know, family was just like not even an option. And then, you know, in 2001, we had the first same-sex marriage introduced in the Netherlands. And the progress that we've made as a community on all of those fronts has been absolutely astounding. And, you know, so there came a point in my life, well, I'm like, well, just because I am gay doesn't mean that, you know, family isn't an option. And so my experience has been that, you know what, it's been a remarkable experience seeing, if I go back to my childhood and imagined what my future would be like as an out gay man and what it actually has been. It has been miraculous. Let me put it that way. I think that's the word I would use to describe it. It's been a very, although very, there were dark moments, you know, it's been such a beautiful, positive outcome. And, I think that is reassuring. And I think that is inspiring for, you know, the future we're heading towards. Like, we're in interesting times. Let me use that word, where we're seeing civil rights and different, you know, we're moving, regressing a little bit on civil rights. It's not unprecedented. You know, I was watching this documentary last night. If you looked at Germany in the 1920s, you know, 1930s, they did have a backward movement in civil rights and freedoms enjoyed by the LGBT community. So it does scare me, but along with kind of the negative and some of the discourse that's going on, there's also a lot of positive. You know, you see, I think one of the Baltic countries elected their first openly gay president. So I think we're up to 37 countries which have same-sex marriage. We're trying to get Aruba to be the 38th. There is an initiative of law, a bill that I propose that's at its final stages. You know, the trans community is much more visible now. I helped kind of organize this support group that started. And now I think we have our first trans man having his identity, his documents reflect the gender, his true gender. And so sometimes it's little by slowly, but there is like these blocks of progress that are happening. That make me hopeful.
So Miguel, you've given us this really broad sweep of your life from the very beginning to now in politics. And while we are going to get to some of the political and the issues of today, we want to stick a little bit at the beginning, towards the beginning, and how that made you both the man and the politician that you are today. So you talked about you knew something was different about the time you were eight, and it was many years later before you had that coming out that was no big deal. But there's a lot of years there in the closet. Were there skills that hiding yourself or blending in with others taught you that you now actually use today? Some things we can look at and say, that might have felt negative, but I learned this ability to connect or to do something else that you might use right now as a leader.
Okay, so I'm going to go back and get really personal about what exactly happened at eight and kind of where I think at that age, it cemented for me being different. I remember we were on a holiday. It was like around Christmas time. We were in, I think we were in Munich. And so I was with my parents and my two sisters. And we went to the swimming pool. And at the hotel swimming pool, and I remember afterwards, my mom and my sisters went to the female change room and my dad and I went to the male change room. And it was the first time I was in kind of, let's say, a sort of a locker room with all these naked men, very attractive naked men. And although it was pre-puberty, I was aroused. So I got an erection. And my father noticed that. And I remember he said, don't look at other people. And I think at that point, he must have realized, or at least doubted greatly, that I was homosexual. And I think his reaction to that was extremely inappropriate. So I think after that, you know, my sisters and I would tease and kind of play and whatever. And I remember I got a beating that was disproportional to that was going on. I remember after that, we were in Switzerland, and I remember we were in a hotel in Zurich. And I remember, I think his fear and anger was being played out in a way that was physically inappropriate, kind of in a sense of beating. And I remember the hotel staff would just look at him with a sense of disgust. And it was just him, you know, not knowing how to process, not knowing how to do that. Today, he's my biggest fan. But at that point, what it did for me, it was, A, it was kind of like rejection from my primary caregivers. So that made my home environment very unsafe, or that's how I interpreted it as an eight-year-old child. And it was also, you know, something which I wouldn't have been able to identify that I was gay or the homosexual. I didn't know that now. But I know that there was something about me that I couldn't change that was not acceptable. So that, I think it, from that moment on, I remember kind of socially, I became more reclusive. Probably kind of, it probably produced some anxiety in social, in kind of things. So, from that moment, it's like, I need to get out of here. That was my reaction as a kid. And I guess the first opportunity came. I was always a good student. I did study well. And, you know, you had this one side. I remember I was also, you know, there was that one side, but I think a compensation also started at that point. One of the things I did enjoy was, like, I was class representative, and then I ran for middle school student president. So although there was this fear and this sense of something being wrong, there was also this outward mask of, you know, no, I'm going to run for class president, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. So I don't know, but everything didn't align, and it wasn't whole. And I think what I always say that, you know, in your teens, when you, I think it's, hopefully it's different nowadays, but it's, you know, when you start having feelings, emotional feelings, feelings of attractions, for me, at least, at that time, you know, exploring any of that was obviously taboo and not a possibility. So whereas a lot of my peers were having their first boyfriend and their first girlfriend, you know, I may have had a girlfriend later on in boarding school, but it was just like to go along with it. What I really wanted was to explore intimately, you know, people with my friends. And so I think it's incredibly damaging. It was for me. A, being rejected by your parents, being, you know, having this, it's kind of like, okay, if that's true, you cannot go there and you cannot live that. And I think, my plan was never to come out. It was actually once I think probably around 19 is when I started gliding into addiction. I think in my early 20s, I think if it wasn't for that and I didn't out myself under the influence of, you know, either drunk or intoxicated or whatever, then it may never have happened. And I always remember this because I remember when I was probably 18, 19, I was in a gay bar in Miami and I saw somebody from Aruba that I grew up with. And, you know, our families were friends and whatever. And it was just this terror in both of us that we had met there. And nothing happened between us, obviously. But, you know, I will take who he is, like his name and last name, to my grave. But weirdly enough, it's somebody who, you know, I see now because he drops off his kids at the same school that my kids go to. And he ended up marrying a woman and this and that. And it's kind of, let's say, in a certain sense, I feel a privilege that at least my life experiences, you know, forced me or gave me the opportunity to live my true self and kind of experience love and heartbreak and all of that. Whereas a lot of people, because of their environment or because of their career goals, don't get that opportunity or didn't have that opportunity. I'm 45 now. So, I mean, it's different, obviously, now for younger generations. So I do you know, I see it often, like, you know, people that were never able to be themselves, never have the freedom to come out. And I think that is, it's incredibly sad. It breaks my heart that, you know, sometimes I think we take for granted, or at least I do, that, you know, everybody's had the opportunity to be themselves and live the life and kind of experience and live attraction to who they want, but it's not the case. And I think despite all kind of the dark years, I do consider myself one of the lucky ones that, you know, I got to do all of that. So it was kind of just going back to 8. And I remember we came back to Aruba after that holidays. And at that point, I knew something was wrong. And kind of had my first and probably only, like, conscious attempt to kill myself. I remember hanging the noose, and I remember crying, and I was standing on my desk because I was going to jump from my desk with the noose on. And my dog had just had puppies, and from my bedroom window, I could see the puppies. And I remember crying and thinking, you know, I cannot kill myself because I'm going to miss these puppies. And for me, that was a higher power, because if my desk was on the other side of the room or the dog didn't have puppies, I probably wouldn't be here. And of course, my parents walked in. They had a completely inappropriate reaction again. I got another beating, and we were raised Catholic. And I think they instilled in me a fear of hell after that. So I never tried consciously to kill myself again. But I think it also, for them, on some level, it's like, we're going to have to change, because if it's between losing our son or accepting him, there's no argument. We're going to accept him. So it was a very traumatic moment. The reaction, and when I've told the story before, it was so inappropriate, and agreed, but it was a turning point. And I remember this. I remember when I did go, and then that was at 8. And then 4 years later, I got the opportunity to leave Aruba. I went to boarding school. And I remember my mother cried and stayed in bed for 3 days. She couldn't get out. And I think although it was never spoken, I think she did realize, you know, he's going away because of how he is. But it's also what I see in the Caribbean. I see, you know, happy families being torn apart. That still happens to this day, just because it's not a loving environment. And it's so much lost time because of prejudices, however they come. And in the end, it's, I think it's a lot of lost time and a lot of people that love each other but end up being separated. And yeah, a lot of completeness missing. So I think, so that covers the 8 to 14. And then, so at boarding school, I was good at passing off as a relatively heteronormative person. I had a girlfriend and stuff like that. I think I went to the wrong country. When I speak to friends of mine who went to boarding school in England, you know, they all had boyfriends. It was all, I'm like, I definitely went to the wrong country. I had no same-sex experience in boarding school. But then I did at university, and that was a very, you know, I remember the first time I was 19, and it happened, and I would always give them the wrong number, because I never wanted to see the same person twice, because I didn't want to develop any type of emotional attachment whatsoever, because that would be dangerous. That would be kind of, let's say, yeah, it would just, in my planning at that moment, I thought it would be dangerous. And so that happened. And I think probably, pushed me into an identity crisis and not really an identity crisis, but like, how is this going to fit into the life I'm planning? And then I think it happened again. I'm like, okay, it happened. I enjoyed it. But it can never happen again. And, you know, I would probably not have another intimate experience with somebody of the same sex for like a year. Then it became 6 months. And then it became, you know, 3 months, and so on and so forth. But I didn't actually have my first... And then kind of like I had the addiction years where I don't think it was a... it wasn't a conscious attempt to kind of, let's say, unalive myself, but it was in that direction. I was using and getting intoxicated in a form that put my life in danger repeatedly. And again, it's kind of like I am a spiritual person. I do believe, in a source of all creation. And I do believe that source is benevolent and kind. And I do credit that source for getting me out, saving me when I was 8 and getting me out of the dark years of alcoholism and addiction. And again, you know, the same people that rejected me when I was 8 for being gay were, you know, really kind of my heroes during that period. Like my parents were, you know, moving heaven and earth to try and help me get sober at that time. And I did. I would be dishonest if I think, you know, if we lived in a more accepting society where the homophobia wasn't that great, all of that drama may not have been necessary.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I was really struck by not only the long period of time being in the closet, actively working to stay hidden, but also not thinking that you would ever come out, not thinking that you were ever going to have the opportunity to live your life. And then it happened. And I'm really just so curious about that before and after of I just did not envision this life. And I had all of these other plans that I was trying to reconcile and figure out how I was going to make them happen. But that piece was off the table. And so after that coming out experience, what did that then do for you? And how did that inform who you've become, despite it being entirely different than what you likely pictured or thought was possible?
So, yes, it became, and I remember when I finally did come out, I was living in Miami, Florida at the time, and I was working as an economist, and it was strange because for the first time in my life, I started having panic attacks and it's happened, but I think for a year, I think I came out and then, I remember having panic attacks. I went to see a mental health professional and we kind of had to deal with kind of the anxiety that it was creating. So, you know, I think I saw a therapist for a year and a half. I think at one point he did kind of prescribe antidepressants. I took antidepressants for a year and a half. And those did help with the anxiety and, you know, and the panic attacks went and I came off the medication. But I was in Miami and I had my first, I remember I was in a gay bar that's been there for forever called Twist. And this really cute young guy, I was leaving and I had gone out with my friends. So I had a group of friends and I had met this young guy who was attractive and he smiling and we got in, I got in my first relationship. I think we dated for a little bit, about 6 months. I think the relationships always bring up, you know, all of your issues. It's kind of like a pressure cooker. So it was a beautiful relationship. We're still friends today. But my experience was that, you know, I had built up all these walls that, you know, I'm going to have to tear down so that relationships can actually work. And because I had missed out on all this time, I just wanted to have fun. I was felt like a kid in a candy store. To this day, I regret. I was like, oh my God, all the sex I could have had in university. And, you know, but anyway. So I had my first relationship and then it kind of brought up, I'm like, whoa, you have a lot of work to do before you can actually have a happy and healthy relationship. But it was a beautiful experience. I had my first boyfriend. I think a little bit after that, I ended up moving to London. In Miami, I still knew a lot of people. It was still, there are a lot of people from the Caribbean in Miami. I think wherever you're from in Latin America or the Caribbean, Miami is your second home because you, you know, there are members of your community there. In London, it was a bit different. Like, I didn't have to look over my back. Whereas I was already, you know, I had a boyfriend and stuff like that, but I probably would have been embarrassed if, you know, I was at a restaurant with him and we had bumped into some friends of my parents. Like, my comfort with being gay hadn't, you know, it wasn't there yet. So I moved to the United Kingdom, and there I did feel like a kid in a candy store, and I felt completely free. I went to my first Pride event in London, and it was such a beautiful, moving experience, and to see the London Parade, and, you know, at that time it would end up in Soho, and, you know, the entire queer communities was there, and it was just such a good feeling, and you felt like you wanted to hug everybody. And the way they did it, or that parade, it was such a cross-section of society. So you saw people of all ages, in all industries. It was just beautifully, beautifully done, and it was really an emotional movement. So then, kind of, when I lived in London, it was really building a new circle of friends initially, and most of them had ended up being queer. And then it happened in life that, you know, my circle of friends that were previous, you know, they everything kind of merged. And I had the big love of my life thus far. I fell in love with this Australian, and who I met at this party. So it was kind of really living, I guess, the freedom of, yeah, of my own identity or my own orientation freely. And happily, and it was really beautiful. I think from in the UK, at least, I didn't suffer any, like, there was never an incident that I didn't suffer. I mean, there was never a homophobic incident. And it was a very healing and beautiful experience and a time in my life. And, you know, I fell in love, I fell out of love. But I remember there was, I dated this Australian, and I think I was around 30 at that time, 29 more or less. And I remember on our first date, we went out to lunch, and one of the questions he had for me, he was a bit younger. So if I was 29, maybe he was like 21, 22, and very different upbringing. Like, I met his family once in Australia, and both his parents were educators. And I remember his mom was telling me, you know, when he was younger, maybe around 11, she noticed that he was a little bit more sensitive than his brother. He used to write poems and distribute it to neighbors. So she thought, you know, and one Sunday, her and her husband, they had the three kids in the back of the car, and she wanted to create a safe space. And she just, you know, voiced out. She's like, kids, if any of you are gay, I would love it. I would absolutely love it. So, you know, very different from my experience, but it was such a beautiful way to create, you know, kind of a safe space in case that happened to be. But he asked me the question, he's like, do you want kids? And I was just like, I just wanted to give him the right answer. I liked him that much. So I was like, I'm open to it. And I heard myself say that. I'm like, what are you talking about? And but it kind of, it planted the seed of having a family in me, something that I thought was not on the table ever. And then my niece was born, and it kind of like renewed my faith in the human spirit. And, you know, I just came to believe that, you know what, having queer parents is, it's not, from my understanding, at that point, I was like, well, actually, it is an option. You know, if you're living in a progressive city, it's not a disadvantage. Every longitudinal study actually shows that the children of queer families tend to be better adapted than those from heteronormative. So something that I thought was never in play kind of came in as a possibility. So I started playing with the idea. 9 years later, I did end up having children, or my first son was born. So it was kind of, let's say, the life I couldn't imagine, as a young person growing up in the Caribbean, I was living. So it was a very happy, beautiful, and positive, change of direction in my life. And I think, you know, the whole imaging of, oh, you know, if you're going to be gay, you're going to be worthy of rejection and ridicule was disproven, completely. And I think, you know, especially that experience, or it made me grateful as well for my sexuality. I do think, like, I always say this, like, I remember growing up, I never got the thing about women going to the bathroom together. Never. I didn't get it. And then once I was out and I had, you know, traveled with gay friends, I'm like, okay, now I get it. I see what that, you know, sistership or fellowship or whatever, I understand what it is, you know? So yeah, it was a really, really beautiful, new beginning. Let's put it that way. New beginning.
So we really appreciate you sharing some of your vulnerability and your humanity with us, because that isn't weakness. That is this ability to connect and to find these bridges that bond us to other people. But earlier you had described that you viewed for the longest time emotional attachment as danger. So what was it? And I think I might know the answer here, but what was it that flipped that for you? Because I'm guessing it's very different today and you no longer see emotional attachment as a problem, but maybe as a boon, a benefit, a leadership tool. How did that change for you?
Absolutely. I think once I had deconstructed the narrative of, I guess, a negative narrative that I had grown up with around homosexual and homosexual relationships, that changed. Once I was out of the closet and living out and proud, that changed, because then the next logical step is, or logical or not, but I mean, the next step would be to be open to meeting somebody like me and, you know, sharing intimate feelings and moments. And I do believe that kind of life is richer when you have someone to share it with, and not necessarily the bad moments, but especially the good moments, the victories. And so whereas something that, as you do, as I did kind of, you know, earlier on in life seemed dangerous, like it would kind of like, it became kind of like my ideal, you know, to be in a loving relationship with a partner.
You shared a bit about the nature of your experiences and how much they changed based on where you lived. And you have such a rich background and you've lived so many places all over the world. What were some of the distinctions or similarities that you found from one culture or one country to the next in the LGBT community? And how did that unfold for you as you went through the different phases of your journey and then were exposed to different communities, different cultures influencing that community? And what are some of those attributes that you saw either distinct or shared amongst members of the community that you had the opportunity to meet?
I think, for example, I always go back to London, I think, because that's where I felt the freest at that time. What I loved about Europe, at least, or my experiences in Europe, it was not an issue. You know, nobody would bat an eye, and it was not, you know, it was kind of, Miami, it was probably me. I think Miami's a little bit different then, but I remember, this is between probably 2002 and 2007. I remember dating at that time in Miami. It was still public displays of affection, let's say out on Lincoln Road or Miami Beach. You still didn't see it that often, and it was probably frowned upon. And in London, it wasn't that experience. I mean, I lived in Soho in the beginning, so it was kind of like at that time, the gay Mecca. And it was very, so I remember, I'll tell you this story. I remember once I was in a relationship with this Portuguese man who, I was living in Madrid at that time, and he came to stay for the weekend, and we walked into town, and he held my hand from the minute we left my building to town, about a 20-minute walk. I think I lost a few years of my life there because I was so incredibly uncomfortable. Like, I had always grown up, maybe it's a Latin thing, but I remember in Miami, it was like PDA, public displays of affection, or frowned upon, you never do it. I remember once I went on a date in London with an American guy, and he wanted to hold my hand in the cinema, and it was just beyond my comfort zone. I would, you know, I was like, no, okay. But here he was, this younger guy, and about 5-6 years younger than me, he grew up in Portugal, and he held my hand and walked for 20 minutes in town. I could have died in the beginning. But it was a healing experience in the sense that we walked the town hand in hand, something I never expected or imagined doing. And nobody batted an eye. It was kind of like the most normal thing. And that world is very different than the world I grew up in. And just to see the progress and change was spectacular. And I think my experience now, or in a lot of the places I've lived, including, you know, I go back to Miami often, what you didn't see openly before is kind of like the most normal thing today, you know, and it was the same in Sydney. And I think that's beautifully reassuring, you know. It's kind of like, especially when I see it, I think representation is incredibly important, because without representation, it's difficult for younger LGBTs to imagine a future. And even the representation, even I'm older, I'm kind of in my 40s now, so, but that representation is healing for me as well, because it's a reminder that this is the world that we live in, that I don't fall back in patterns. And so when I see young people, young LGBT couples walking hand in hand, making out in public, I love to see it. It's such a beautiful reassurance. And weirdly enough, we see it in Aruba. And, you know, I can be sitting in a restaurant in the hotel zone, I see two men walking hand in hand, I'm like, what? But it's kind of like, it's a beautiful reassurance of how much we've progressed and you know, how much freer and better things are, at least in that respect.
So let's get to Aruba, because you lived around the world, you found yourself, you built a family, all these amazing things, but it wasn't until recently that you were basically called home, as it were, and called home to lead and to form a political party that represented the 21st century. Can you talk a little bit about why you think LGBTQ leaders are so suited to help pull us all into the 21st century, to lift other people up and, you know, have this mindset that says we can be better tomorrow than we are today, despite our circumstances? How do you see LGBTQ leaders doing that, both around the world and now you doing it on Aruba?
I really think LGBT people are exceptionally suited to lead, simply because all of us have broken with the mold, have broken with a heteronormative mold. And when you look at the 21st century, the changes that are coming, whether it's, you know, singularity, where artificial intelligence will overtake human intelligence, whether it's, you know, and I think we're living in a century where the prevailing economic model of the past couple of centuries will not prevail. I'm an economist, finance, so I always take that route. So we will reach a point in this century that there will not be enough jobs for everybody who needs one. So this prevailing economic model that you need a job to survive and stuff like that. So I do think this century is going to be the one that we are going to have to rewrite the rules. And, you know, you see a few countries in North America and in Europe, they're starting to play with universal basic income. So I think I see it going in two directions. Either we're going to see an ever greater concentration of capital and the disbalances that that might cause, or we're going to, and the society that I'm hoping to create, it's kind of like when we ran the elections, we do want to introduce a universal basic income by 2050 in Aruba. And by that is we want to create a situation where the state guarantees your basic necessities, your survival, your food, water, and shelter should be guaranteed. Because I do find that right now we're living in a society economically that's quite hostile. And I think if we can change that, and I think, you know, because of the direction that we're going, we will get the opportunity to change that. Then I think the society that I would like to create is one where, yeah, your survival is guaranteed by the state. I think free enterprise is incredibly important. It's the most efficient form of asset allocation. But I do think we need kind of a bit of a rebalancing. I kind of hoped that more of a reset would have happened after the pandemic. It doesn't seem that that happened, but I do think it's unavoidable. You know, just the accumulated public debt around the world and the growth rates, it's, we're going to hit into a wall there. And so I think leaders from the LGBT community who have already had to reject the heteronormative that they saw all around them are better placed to think outside of the box, come with solutions. And because they've seen them live and kind of work in their own lives, they're better suited to make them, to kind of carry them out in practice. It's kind of, let's say, and oftentimes, you know, I always hear this from some colleagues, like, oh, but change happens very slowly. I'm like, not really. Like, I've seen it in my life. Change has happened very, very, very quickly. So I know it's possible. So I do think the personal experiences that we all have, I'm sure some people nowadays have different, but it's, you're outside of the majority. So you're from a minority. So that gives you a unique perspective as well into prejudice, into, oftentimes we've lived prejudice. So we have a better understanding of what it feels being on the outside. So I think those, yeah, unique attributes or unique experiences do make better leaders. And especially now where we want to kind of learn how to live in community better with people with differences of opinion and different viewpoints. I think that's really the challenge now. How do we continue to live in as a community and set a good example for younger generations and kids, even though we're in disagreement?
Yeah, I think we've seen many of those same themes in the folks that we've spoken to. And certainly, you know, the ability to understand that change is possible and come up with creative solutions to move things forward is something that you've exemplified thus far in your political career. And we want to talk a little bit about those accomplishments, but I know it also has not been without strife. And even some of that prejudice that you had to face during this period of time, even being the target of a hate campaign, would you share a little bit about that experience?
Sure. So in Aruba, we're very close to marriage equality. Let me put it that way. One of the campaign promises I made was that same-sex marriage would be something that we push for. I sit in the opposition right now, but regardless, I brought a private member's bill to introduce same-sex marriage to Aruba. So as a result of that, and there were a few things happening at the same time. So you have the private member's bill making its way through parliament. We're ready for the debate. I did get two other parties. We're five parties in the parliament right now. So three of the factions are supporting the bill, and the other two factions are divided. Some members are pro, some members are against. All along, based on their personal pledges, politicians are difficult to trust. So you can't. But all along, we've had a majority for it. We've also done scientific polling as a party on this subject, and it was remarkable. In 2022, 57% of Arubans support same-sex marriage. 43% are against, but 57 support it. So we do have a majority both in the people and in the parliament to pass it. You know, like it happens in other countries, those that are opposed have, you know, are trying every trick in the book to slow down the process. But when the law was submitted, and there was, independently of the law, there was a gay rights organization called Fundación Orgullo, aligned along with one from Curaçao, which is another Dutch sister island right within the kingdom. They went to court. They followed kind of the U.S. path, and they won in the court of first appeals, and then they won in the court of second appeals on the 6th of December. And that ruling said, based on the anti-discrimination clause of the Constitution of Aruba and the anti-discrimination clause of the Constitution of Curaçao, same-sex couples have the right to marriage. So that ruling came out on the 6th of December. The government had until the 7th of March to appeal. Both the government of Curaçao and the government of Aruba have appealed that decision. So it's now going to the Dutch equivalent or the Supreme Court in the Netherlands. We'll get a ruling next year. So that happened on December 6th. On December 16th, we introduced the same-sex marriage law. Obviously, if the law passes, then the appeal process becomes null and void. And then we had a group of churches, along with some politicians that come from, you know, or members of those churches. They started this a campaign to collect signatures to force the government of Aruba didn't take the decision whether, because the two coalition partners were divided, whether they should appeal or not. And we were hopeful that they wouldn't. But anyway, they started this signatory campaign and to force the government or to request the government to go to the appeals. And during that time, it got very hateful. And I will say, though, that their goal was to get 20,000 people to sign to deliver this petition to the government to go to the Supreme Court or to appeal the decision. And they didn't reach their goal. They got, I think, about 16,000 signatures, unverified. So we don't know if people have signed twice or whatever, but they did present it. It's remarkable because 16%, 16,000 people is about maybe 15% of our population. And even if you assume it voters, it's about 30% of our voters. So they came nowhere near anything of a majority. But they do feel that they can impose their interpretation of scripture and doctrine over the whole community. And then during all of this, in March, the Atlantis cruise came. And anyway, it was, they organized a beach party. It was like 5,000 people. They organized a beach party, and they had told the people on the cruise that the beach party was within walking distance. So when you had 5,000 gay men walk out, a lot of them in kind of like skin-colored tangas, walk through the main town here, it was like hell had broken loose, in a sense that it started, not all of them, but a few of those religious leaders had misused the visit of the cruise to fight same-sex marriage. It was a breaking point for a few reasons. It was a breaking point because that really intensified the hate campaign. And so I think there was, I don't remember, if it might have been before the cruise. It might have been when I handed in the law. There was like about a week. We're a small island. I mean, I get, you know, messages from constituents, but the intensity of hate that we experienced as a community was unexpected. It did take me aback. I think I got maybe 100 hate messages like in 1 week, which I think was a top, like wishing me death, wishing me cancer, telling me my kids would never be happy, you know, all sorts of horrible things. And so it really divided our society. And then the cruise came and they're like, oh, is this what you want for the island? And what was, because I did come out, I did kind of, the gays were having a PR nightmare. So I did come, but luckily a few of those priests came and they kind of manifested, or they protested in front of parliament, and they threatened elected members of the elected representatives of the government. And then I needed to change the discourse. So I thought, you know, what would Nancy Pelosi do? And so I put out a press release and I'm like, you know, elected leader, kind of religious leaders that come and threaten elected representatives, try to topple our constitutional order because we have separation of church and state, you know, should face consequences. It did change the discourse. So then everything was like, oh my God, you know, I became the devil. But anyway, the result of was that it polarized our society deeply. And what it did happen though was it also broke the Christian community. So whereas they had an alliance amongst all the priests, at that point, some of them said, no, if you're going to go this far and misuse the cruise to attack this community, we're not standing with you. So whereas they were a unified front initially saying, okay, we'll accept civil unions, but we won't accept marriage. At that point, we kind of started having them like, no, and I had a lot of conversations because during this whole debate, a lot of, there were four or five pastors, I think, that reached out to me personally and said, you know, we don't support this. And I'm like, well, where are your voices? You know, because right now the community could really use these voices. They're like, listen, it's the first time in Aruba that all the churches are talking to each other. So we have like communication between them. So we don't want to break that at this point. So I'm like, you know, so I had some strong arguments with some of them. And I was like, well, what would Jesus do? You know, I'm like, it's wonderful that you're coming to tell me that you are against this, but I'm not the one that has to hear it. The person who has to hear it are kind of young members of the community that feel ostracized, that, you know, you have this horrible discourse that was very damaging for everybody. And, you know, so the hate campaign, it was kind of like, it did throw me aback and it did think, you know, well, maybe we haven't made as much progress as we thought. It made me reflect, well, you know what, maybe Aruba is not a safe place for me to raise my two kids who are 6 and 3. So it, you know, at that point, it was kind of like, I think we saw not the nicest version of our community. Since then, I think we have, the majority has held for same-sex marriage. But it really divided society. And I have to say, kind of, let's say this year's Pride, a lot of the efforts were made in educating the population, you know, I always say that the same diversity that exists amongst heterosexuals exists amongst the LGBT population, you know, from political standpoints to religious standpoints to personalities, you know, you cannot generalize. And but we saw a lot of people come out and kind of like share their stories and educate, like, you know, what our experiences are like. And I do feel that there's been a moment of reflection. And I think I'm cautiously saying we're healing from that experience, because the law has continued to progress, but those public outbursts and attacks have not resurfaced, because I think a lot of people that, you know, were religious and participated in the churches left as well. They were like, you know, this does not represent my beliefs. But it was really, I guess, I don't like using the term culture war, but it was definitely, I think you have two completely different viewpoints colliding. And one of the interesting things was that after I came out with my press release condemning the religious leaders that, you know, came and threatened members of parliament and wanted to go against our separation of church and state, I did have a meeting with a Christian pastor who I respect. And, you know, what they embraced in me was like, you're an elected leader. You know, one of the things that I kind of like, she published a news piece or a commentary, and she's like, we have these different viewpoints. We have to learn to live in community with each other and set the right example for the kid. I think what I learned from my conversation was that although, let's say, we're not going to come to an agreement, as an elected official, you know, the separation of church protects the church, and it also protects the state. And that's what we both agreed on. You know, that separation has to remain very clear, because once the church tries to meddle in affairs of the states, you're opening a door for the state to meddle in affairs of the church. And we had a lot of those conversations. The conversation now, and I've kind of just sent a letter to the state secretary for kingdom affairs in The Hague, because the churches are pushing, oh, we'll accept same-sex civil unions. And I'm like, that's a separate but equal argument. Separate but equal goes back to a doctrine, maybe, you know, in the U.S. you had segregation, where people of color were made to sit in the back of the bus. It was argued at that time that they would be arriving at the same destination. So it's not discriminatory, but it's just separate. Now, obviously, we recognize that as institutionalized discrimination. So the argument has now progressed, like, civil unions only or is institutionalized discrimination that violates our constitution. So we're having those arguments, and I understand, and I always say, like, you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this, you know, with, let's say, for example, the religious right. But we do all have a responsibility as community leaders to kind of, let's say, do this in the most respectful way possible, because we are setting example for younger generations. But yeah, and that's kind of like where we are now. Being the target of a hate campaign was unsettling. And again, it took me back to like, okay, well, maybe we're not as we haven't progressed as much as I had. Is this a safe place for me to raise kids? It takes you back there. So it's not a pleasant experience. I didn't waver at any point, because it's like, especially when you're, then it's like, okay, no, now we're going to double down to get this passed. So it was kind of, let's say, obviously I had my doubts of kind of, let's say, how safe for safety, which I really regretted. And especially that, you know, you hope when you're in politics that your family stays, you know, that they focus on you and, you know, your private life and your family are left out of it. But those arguments can get very nasty, and those campaigns and targets can be very nasty.
So one of the things that I think is hopeful is having your representation there, and being something that younger generations can look up to, that may not have happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago, in most countries around the world. And it kind of speaks to the fact that we wanted to study LGBTQ leadership, why it's different, why it's valuable. And that's one of the things that is really important. But while we have our personal reasons why we believe LGBTQ leadership is so important, what are yours? And really, our closing question is, why did you want to come on this show? What made you want to be a part of talking about how LGBTQ leaders are made?
So I wanted to come on the show, hopefully to inspire other LGBT leaders, maybe in small countries or places where they haven't been elected yet, or even in places where they have. If you look at the percentage of the LGBT community as part of the general population, we're underrepresented in public office. So the percentage of elected LGBT people around the world, even in progressive countries in North America and Europe, is smaller than the general population. So hopefully to kind of inspire more LGBT members to stand for public office, we bring a unique viewpoint. Nobody's going to advocate for your issues better than your own community. That's just a fact. But also, it's incredibly important to have our experiences are unique. You know, there are other minorities that have faced prejudice, persecution, all of that, but it's a unique minority where it deals with orientation and gender identity, which I don't think other minorities have that same experience. And it's important that we're there. So our voices being heard in a public meeting, in committee meetings, shifts. It shifts opinions because it's no longer an abstract concept that we're discussing. We're discussing about Miguel. And I've had conversations with colleagues that say, you know, and it sometimes it just comes down to, I'm like, but do you believe that you have more rights than me? And then, of course, the answer is, of course not. I'm like, well, how can you say that? You know, so sometimes just having the person in front of you asking you that, it shifts opinion. It shifts people. And I think that's incredibly valuable. And it goes back to representation. I always say that, you know, those that came before us have opened the way. And it's our responsibility to continue opening the way for those that are going to come after us.
Beautifully said. Miguel, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciated having you on the show. We wish you the best in the campaigns that you have, and hopefully the hate dies down and everyone gets to move forward in a positive way. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Forged in Fire is hosted by Bree Fram and Liz Cavallero. Produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos and Christina George. Guest management by Trey Worth and original music by Bridget Benemark. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. To learn more about Forged in Fire, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.